Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to the show and happy Canada Day weekend.
You too, and to all the listeners.
Cheap money. Turns out, with some of the repayment schedules, cheap money wasn't all that cheap. Is that the case?
Yeah, well, there's the repayment schedule, yeah. But really the problem of cheap money, that 12-year period where central banks kept rates nearly, on a real basis in Canada, they were negative, meaning that the nominal rates were less than the cost of living. So the incentives there were to speculate on assets. And the problem there is it drove up things like housing, which, of course, is the most consumed asset in Canada, well, anywhere in the world, really. But what happened here was low rates enabled people to borrow even more. And so that enabled prices to go up even more. And so we had this really awful inflation period where people thought they were getting ahead by borrowing lots of money. You know, they thought they were getting rich by going broke, basically. And then what happens in all bubbles, it's very typical, is once the prices start to stagnate or not rise further, once buyers start struggling to be able to take properties off existing owners and you can't have that move-up function, then you start to see weakness. And of course, so now we get the rate hiking cycle that came in reaction to the inflation in the system, which was a function of both the COVID stimulus and the low rates. But we got that quick hiking period where they normalized rates, Jim. It's not that interest rates are so high. Historically, they're about normal in here. The trouble is that the prices of things like cars, everything that was financed, things you could buy for houses, like appliances, like vehicles, as I said, like houses themselves, which is the largest expenditure for a household, those things all went up an incredible amount. So far more than long-term norms, which, by the way, real estate over a very long period has averaged about a 5% gain per year, a bit more than the cost of living. And that is why over time prices have typically gone up. But when you get into a period where, like I said, in the COVID period, where interest rates in Canada were less than 3% for mortgages, some were paying half of that. Some were getting mortgages for 1.5%. All that did was allow them to overpay. And now we have this problem with the interest rate part being normalized, but also the price being still way too high. Now, it's starting to come down, of course, because the average sale price at the peak in like February of 22 was over 800,000. The latest data suggests it's about 699,000, the average sale price. So the price is coming down, but not nearly enough in order to make it affordable for the masses. So, you know, we had that kind of disinflationary tailwind as interest rates were falling, and that made the cost of carry, because mortgage interest costs are literally part of the CPI basket. In Canada, 30% of the CPI basket that everyone talks about, the cost of living index, is made up out of shelter costs, which are 24% increases or changes in rents, and also mortgage interest, utilities are in there. So these are the things that really drive the bulk of inflation in the country. So when you get, now we've got, you know, I was writing about this this week because, you know, the CPI number surprised to the upside. this week, where we've had 5 months of falling inflation reads. So, you know, markets were sort of signaling a bit of a sigh of relief. Treasury bonds, which are much better at figuring out the economic cycle than stocks have ever been historically, they saw that inflation peaked last fall and that it had been coming off sequentially month over month lower rate, and that was going in the right direction. That disinflationary impulse is what central banks have been targeting, and that's what they wanted to see happening. We've seen this trend in lower home prices all going in the right direction. The problem is that so much of the mortgages that were taken out, as I say, during the pandemic have been coming up for renewal and will do so for the next couple of years. And as they do, they're seeing they're seeing payments leap, right? Because rates have normalized. And even if central banks go to cut rates a lot, or a couple of hundred basis points or 300 basis points is a typical cutting cycle, once they start to do that, the problem is that'll still likely mortgage rates will still be higher as they come up for renewal from these ultra low period. So again, this is this cost I was speaking about of low rates costing us a lot. They cost us a lot in productivity. They cost us a lot in misallocation of resources. A lot of dumb things were done with money when it was free. That's pretty typical. When you look at the supply of housing in Canada, we've got this mismatch. We've got a ton of these condos that were built during the easy money era that are less than 300 square feet, 400 square feet, basically not even something that, you know, something a single person would have a hard time living in, let alone families or a couple. And that was where the bulk of the supply was being built. And the reason for that was there was a whole bunch at the ultra low rate point in 2021-22, about 50% or 60% of those condos were being bought by so-called investors, where they weren't doing any kind of due diligence with respect to realistic expectations of who would live in that. They weren't intending to live in it, right? It was this, what I call mindless capital allocation, where they're just like, oh, I'm an investor, because I could get a loan from the bank and I could buy one of these properties. And they have, you know, in their eyes, they're not really looking at the math of the matter. They're looking at, oh, who cares what it can rent for? Who cares if I can barely cover the costs? The point is they see it as a speculative asset where it's going to go up a lot per year. So they're like, we don't care if the rent barely covers, you know, it's a money bank and we're making gains year over year. Well, of course, that's all stopped. And now we've got this surge in that supply coming on in major cities. And so the problem is prices are still expensive. So a bunch of people are moving to now list these properties and finding they can't get the price that they paid for it 2 or 3 years ago. People are having a hard time qualifying for mortgages. The amount of mortgages in the first four months of this year were less than 100,000. Which is very little, something like 1,500 approved mortgages a day. And you've got a country where you've got like 315,000 properties for sale, something like that. So you can just see that there's a lot more supply coming online and buying demand or ability hasn't revived. And that is what's showing up. The Toronto sales data for real estate, as an example, there's more than 14 months of supply at the current sales rate. That's really ballooned in the past year. And prices are under pressure. Now, at the same time, back to this conundrum of the ultra low rate problem and how it's costing us so much here, is that within that, each time a mortgage comes up for renewal, you know, they're facing higher mortgage interest costs of the people who bought or took these loans out during the ultra low rate. So they look to increase rents, right? Because they're now aware that prices are not going up month over month. In fact, they're stagnant or going down. So now they're very concerned with whether or not rent's covering their increased mortgage costs, right? Property taxes, utilities, all the condo fees, all the things that go with property ownership. So now the owners that thought of themselves as investors are looking to rent these things out and looking at how do we get rents up quickly because they want a big increase. And sure enough, in the CPI basket in May, we saw that rents increased by more than 8%. And that was higher than they'd increased in April. And so that's this shock that came to the system of, oh no, if that 30% of the CPI basket starts going back up here, You know, the Bank of Canada is not going to be able to ease as much as markets had been hoping, or many debtors had been hoping, that they were going to, you know, do a lot of cuts, and the next one would be on July 24th in their next meeting. But yesterday the bond market backed up because it looked at the CPI data and said, oh dear, this rent component, which is being driven by higher interest rates to a large degree, because as I said, the investor class is trying to now make a spread or have more cash flow to cover their increased costs. So that is pushing on CPI going in the wrong direction, and that is going to be a headwind for central banks easing as much as many people have been hoping. And so then when the bond market sees that, the bond market sells off sharply as it did the last couple of days, and right away you've got the purview of higher mortgage rates in the system, because the Treasury market actually sets mortgage rates, not the Bank of Canada. So as soon as you get the big sell-off in the Treasury market, the meaning yields are higher, then you're looking at even higher mortgage costs. And now you've got this, you know, what was a virtuous circle when rates were low and money was free and everyone was speculating is now a vicious cycle, right, where every time they try and, you know, improve the system, it actually makes it worse because there's this, you know, higher rate impact costs, impact higher rents, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a painful process. I do think that the Bank of Canada will cut rates, but you know they are up against a bit of a hard spot here. If CPI starts going up in the next couple of months again, it's going to be harder for them to justify it. They're going to have to see, you know, a much higher increase in, or at least a jumps in the unemployment rate. Unemployment rate in Canada has already gone up significantly, right? More than 140 basis points. And they're only expecting, the Bank of Canada has only projected that it'll go up another couple of 20 basis points between now and the end of the year. But the thing is, we're getting a lot of layoffs here. We're getting a lot of financial strife. You know, you've got Canadian bankruptcies up 93% now, Jim, year over year. You know, you're seeing a lot of mortgage defaults all of a sudden. Canadian mortgage delinquencies rose 24% year over year, according to Equifax. So you've got this, like I say, there's a lot of pain in this system, but you've got some limitations on how much rates can be lowered by central banks because of this stubborn inflation from the shelter component. And that's hitting households really hard, and at a time when job losses are spreading. So all of that just suggests that the economy is weaker and will weaken more, because they're trying to, you know, if they stay higher for longer, then there's even less relief in the system, et cetera. So this means that eventually they're going to start cutting faster than is presently predicted. And I think that means that, you know, government bonds will rally sharply again. But we've definitely had a hiccup this week.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, when they start cutting rates at a regular basis, is that actually predicting a recession? Things are so bad they have to already?
Well, it's a coincident response. So they do it in reaction to, so all the people that are thinking that, you know, coming rate cuts will be the panacea or the you know, sign that all is well, don't know their history. Because the reality is that they, you know, hold off till they see the surge in unemployment, which is a lagging indicator. They hold off till they see the inflation rate falling sharply, which is, again, a very lagging indicator. So by the time you get unemployment really spiking, although it's been moving higher already, as I say, significantly so in Canada and in the U.S. too, but once they see those things really start to jump above their expected levels, and inflation usually is weakening dramatically at the same time, by then it's because the economy is slowing really quickly, indeed in a recession. Typically you've never seen this amount of backup in the unemployment rate in Canada without there already being several months into a recession. So it could be that the recession has already begun, and we won't really know that officially until backward-looking data. But the point, I guess, again, is that the central banks cutting rates at the short end doesn't solve all the problems quickly. Just as it hiking didn't, you know, wipe out the economy right away, it took many months for the impacts. It takes up to a couple of years for the impacts to really start to filter through, as we're seeing now, right? So it's just been more than a couple of years now since the first tightening began, starting in March of 2022. And we're really seeing it, as I was saying, in the bankruptcy data and the delinquency data and people falling behind on payments and cutting back on consumption. Discretionary spending is really down. Retail sales are taking a hit across the board. So all of that suggests that rates are biting now. So no, we aren't through the worst of the biting impact. We're just starting to really get it felt now. And yes, in every case, when central banks began cutting interest rates, since at least 1969, a recession began at or shortly after the first rate cut. And P.S., this is really important for people that are sort of unaware of cycles, the stock market has always bottomed 13 to 33 months after the last Fed rate hike. So not before they start cutting. So people thinking, oh, well, you know, the stock market's rebounded since last fall, so the bottom was last fall. Well, that would be unprecedented, right? Because again, we haven't seen the worst of the economic fallout yet from the hiking cycle because of the two-year lag. And we also know that historically they respond to really bad data with the cuts. It's not because things are looking good that they start cutting. It's that things look so bad. And that's when the stock market starts to really implode. And, you know, if you look at the things that bullish people say, oh, you know, jobs have held up better than we expected. Well, maybe so, but that's actually a lagging indicator, unemployment, and it takes quite a while to filter through. So that's not surprising that the unemployment rate looks always pretty relatively decent heading into a recession. It's during the recession that it starts to really spike. The other thing is that, you know, people will point to a decent GDP quarter and say, oh, you know, well, the growth was still positive in the U.S. as an example. Canada's had very anemic GDP growth, almost like 0.5% average over the last year. So we've already been pretty brutal in terms of our momentum in the economy, but the U.S. held up better. But again, that's just typical. You often see that heading into a recession, that the quarter before all hell breaks loose, things look relatively okay, right? And then also, as I said, the last thing that's been holding up household wealth, for a while there, it was stimulus payments during the pandemic that gave households more cash, as we know, and they spent it. They saved some of it, but that's been largely spent. So the other thing that really improved their net worth during that period was rising home prices, number one, because that's the most widely held asset, and then a rebounding stock market, again, because it bounced sharply from 20 into 22. But if you look at today, Jim, the stock market has been, you know, more and more concentrated in this sort of five most expensive tech companies in the United States that have driven, you know, 60% of the gains in the stock market in the last little while. And the average S&P 1500 shares, so a broad basket of 1500 of the largest companies in America, the average stock in that basket is actually flat since 2022. And the Canadian stock market is trading where it was in November of 2021. And the Russell 2000, which is the small cap, you know, more economically sensitive companies, not the big Apples and Amazons of the world, that basket of companies is actually negative 17% since it peaked in the fall of 21. So we've got a whole lot of nothing going on here in terms of sideways action and asset prices. And people may think, well, that means we're due for a big bounce here. But historically, as I said, you don't get the real declines in the stock market until you get into the rate cutting cycle. And that's when all hell breaks loose in terms of earnings for companies. And then people realize that they've paid an extraordinary sum for expected future earnings and sales, which are now getting, you know, shellacked. And if you look at what the main drivers of the stock market cycle have been, it's definitely been the tech basket. And of course, the tech, basket itself in the S&P tech sector, the U.S. being the leader in this worldwide at the moment. But that basket of shares is trading at 10 times sales, Jim, which is Looney Tunes. Like, that has been, you know, 2 times sales is considered good value. 10 times sales is considered mental illness. And then you've got the highest, most widely held components of that basket, like the NVIDIAs of the world, trading at something like 47 times sales, you know, Microsoft 16 times sales, Apple 9 times sales. So these are all really ridiculous valuations, which again tells me that we've not seen the bottom in this stock market cycle, because we've had this narrowing concentration into a smaller and smaller cohort of these companies that everyone's put blind faith in and made bad allocations into, and they're highly concentrated. And the household sector today, Jim, has the highest allocation to equities that we've ever seen in history. They have more than 35% of their net worth in the stock market right now. That's even higher than at the tech top in 2000 when it was about 30%. And the long-term average since 1955 has been about 20%. So they've almost got twice as much in stocks. And that's a function of this ballooning prices that's happened again in the, you know, during the tech mania stuff. And so when you, this is the other problem with economic cycles. What makes them so bad, when they start to turn down? A couple of factors. If you have a high amount of debt in the economy, this makes things all the more fragile, of course. But if you also have a bulk of whatever savings are available in companies and in households in things like the stock market, which is inherently unstable and goes through a big thumping downturn during recessions, then all of a sudden the net worth people thought they had that they were going to draw on, you know, if they start losing their jobs or they have less employment, less income in businesses, they look to their savings, and their savings is positively correlated with all this and tanking at the same time. So this is why it you know, these asset bubbles make things look better on the way up. It makes things look more prosperous. People think they're getting ahead. But by the exact same token, they make things much worse when the downturn comes. And this is our complaint about central banks in general, right? They were brought in to supposedly, you know, smooth, be the lender of last resort, you know, mute downside cycles and depressions so that they don't last as long as they did, you know, pre the founding of, for example, the U.S. Fed in the United States. But in fact, in the last 30 years, what they've done is magnify the cycles. They've magnified them on the upside, but to a large degree by manipulating interest rates too low. And then, of course, that very same effect, the other side of that exact thing, is that it makes things much worse on the downside when all the leverage bursts. And so that's why they've really not done their function of trying to smooth, but rather they've magnified.
Do you see shades of the dot-com bubble burst back in 2000 where, again, companies just threw the word or the letters dot-com on anything and people threw money at it without checking it out?
Absolutely. I remember it very well. I joined into the financial sector in 1997 is when I came into the market. And I had really no clue of historic precedent or cycles at that point. So I was really trying to, you know, I just doing my CFA and trying to figure out, okay, this company should be trading according to good long-standing, you know, rules of thumb in terms of valuation ratios and in terms of historical precedent. Good value would be, say, $30 a share. And then you'd look at it and it would be trading at $300 a share. And you'd think, you know, what am I missing? This is crazy. And the next day it would be $500 a share or something. And, you know, and so people were all saying, well, those rules are old fashioned. You know, this is a brave new era. This is, you know, you don't understand about technology. The internet is changing everything. So everyone just threw out all these long standing, tools, valuation metrics, measurements, you know, things that we had learned through centuries of experience were important in terms of deciding whether something was an investment or a speculation. They threw all that out. And so what happened, of course, was the usual outcome, which was a 2-year drubbing where the tech sector fell by more than 80%, and the general stock market went down as well, about 50%. And I always like to remind people that back then we didn't have nearly the leverage in the system. We didn't have nearly the household debt, certainly not in Canada. We'd had a flat housing market pretty much from about 1990 through to 2000. Housing prices in Canada really didn't go much up because they'd got so overinflated into the late 80s, and then we had that big housing-led recession. We had one in early 80s and one in the late 80s, and people got, you know, big losses in housing and a lot of bankruptcies and defaults, just like we're seeing now. And then, you know, when the stock market bubble burst again, all that apparent wealth people thought they had evaporated, and all of a sudden people are looking for cash, which is very typical. You know, they go into these cycles with almost no cash, which is where we are today. And professional fund managers are almost zero help in terms of risk management. It's a joke. They have less than 4% cash presently on the books. Most households have no actual bonds. They have just the junkiest, riskiest, highest fee generating securities is what people have, because that's how the system likes to make money. And so it just makes them horribly prepared. And the real travesty is not only that there's, you know, these people horribly prepared to lose their life savings and have all these horrible outcomes, but if you're not prepared in advance and you preserve no liquidity, you have no cash, and you've got lots of debt, you're in no position to take advantage of this, right? Which is the most important part of an investment cycle, is having liquidity and know-how and having done the work in advance to know when things are great value so that you can take advantage of that and to purchase them. And that'll set you up for years afterwards with higher dividends, which you can reinvest, which drives compound returns, which is the whole essence of investment gains over time come from this, getting a good yield and reinvesting it and letting that compound. Unfortunately, people today are not at all set up for that. Most people don't even know that that's the driver of investment returns over time. And so it's going to be a painful lesson again, I think.
That was the secret to Warren Buffett's success.
Well, his and longevity.
Yeah.
His net worth has, you know, I think something like quadrupled since he turned 70, something like that. I mean, he's just been around so long and continued to do it for so long. And, you know, the reinvestment of the dividends mean the book value has been rising. Now, my concern about Berkshire Hathaway, though, is it's largely an S&P following index now, because it got so big and it's got such large positions in all the typical stuff, including Apple. So it's really just been benchmarking the broad S&P index, which people think is a diverse way to participate in the stock market. But in the current configuration, where 27% of it is the top five stocks and, you know, 35% of it is the top 10 stocks, and then you've got all these people replicating that or trying to benchmark it or, you know, mimic it in their portfolios, either through holding the index or holding a portfolio that reflects the index, including things like Berkshire, which are highly correlated now together. And so I think that it's going to be shocking to people how much this so-called broad basket of stocks, including things like Berkshire, which they think of as more conservative, they're going to be shocked at the extent to which those prices also correct. And, you know, the good news for Buffett, in the sense of they do have a holding of a large amount of cash right now. So that will definitely help to buffer, and it'll mean they have liquidity to buy off people who are liquidating. So that'll ultimately be positive, but I still think their price risk is very high.
The capital gains tax increase or eligibility increase is now in effect in Canada. Is it going to have a big impact on investment in the country?
Well, it's going to be painful for people, more painful for some of this category of people who were buying these secondary properties during the ultra low rate era. So it's just like another kick in the shins here, because now they're trying to sell them. You know, they can't get what they paid for. They're negative carry monthly. They're finding that they're sitting there having to cut the prices and they're still not attracting buyers. And now, to add insult to injury, when they go to sell it, you know, they're going to be facing, if they did it personally, there's a buffer of capital gain, but above that, they're going to be paying 66% taxable, not 50% taxable at their marginal rate. So it'll just mean less net overall. But if they have a capital loss, then I guess that they can deduct that at a higher rate as well. So, it's not great news for anybody in that scenario. But I think that generally speaking, it's a red herring because, there's so much going on about, you know, it's going to deter tax, investment. Well, when we had capital gains that were only 50% inclusive and we have this big principal residence exemption and we had ultra low interest rates, what did we get? We got a big mosh pit of malallocation. We got a housing bubble that's costing us plenty and will do now for years. Our productivity was in the toilet. This was all while capital gains was just 50%. So I think it's a little bit absurd to assert that just because we're now going to have to pay a higher capital gains that we're going to be so much worse off. The truth is that in periods of high productivity in the past, in decades before, we had higher tax rates both for corporations. We had an 75% capital gains inclusion rate in the late 90s. I remember that, Jim. And productivity back then was better than it is today. So I really don't think, I think that the amount to which this is included is not driving the bus. What's driving the bus is what people are incented to do with their investment capital and whether it's this speculative asset hoarding or whether it's innovation and R&D and productive in terms of making new businesses and business models. So to the extent that entrepreneurs keep doing that, I really don't think that increasing the capital gains rate is going to have an impact.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us and have a great Canada Day.
Thank you, Jim. You too.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.